Hello and welcome to episode 427 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous. Just hit us up on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or send us a voice recording of your question to help at thinkinglsat.com. If you can just record in a quiet place, keep it to under 30 seconds, you can skip the line and ask us questions. Monday, November 13th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. That is Ben's class, but I'm going to crash to do some team teaching, and we are going to do some extra logical reasoning on that day in honor of the LSAT starting in October, changing pretty dramatically, getting rid of the logic games and adding an additional section of logical reasoning. It's going to become a very heavily logical reasoning test starting next August.
Yeah. Why did you say starting in October?
Oh, did I misspeak? My bad. Starting in August is new LSAT with twice as much LR fun. So all of our classes at LSAT Demon are going to be moving in that direction. Of course, not yet. We're hoping that this one last batch of students crushes the LSAT logic games.
Yeah.
So we're doing that. But we're also going to be adding some bonus logical reasoning content. Everybody can get good at LR. So anyway, that's Wednesday, November 13th for all paid subscribers, basic, premium, and live. We're going to do a live class on Zoom with me and Ben. Wednesday, November 22nd, free for everybody. All you need is a Demon free account. I'm teaching a class 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, Wednesday, November 22nd. This was changed from previously stated November 23rd. So just a heads up that we moved that date. Go to lsat.link/free if you want to sign up for my free class on Wednesday, the 22nd.
That must be the day before Thanksgiving.
Yes, it is the day before Thanksgiving. I had a Thanksgiving class and I moved it, bumped it one day forward.
Cool.
Gold star for Ben. Hey, what do you think of this photo I took? What do you think of this bumper sticker on this car?
Poetry is necessary.
Yeah, I thought that was a good discussion topic maybe for the podcast.
Sure.
You have any bumper stickers?
I do not. I prefer a clean bumper.
So do I. Well, I prefer not to go around wearing like a little badge that says I know things more than you know them. You know, it's kind of like every bumper sticker sort of says the same thing, which is like I know better than you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, this one, it's a nice sentiment, I think. But the sense of the idea here is it just that's all the bumper sticker says. The bumper sticker says poetry is necessary.
Yep.
And I like did a double take and had to walk back down the road and go take a picture of it.
I like
mean?
That this is a parked car that Nate is taking a picture of versus you trying to hover over your dashboard while you're driving, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a lot easier as a pedestrian. So what does it mean? I think that there's maybe a little LSAT logic or LSAT logical reasoning lesson here. What does it mean? Or does it mean anything to say poetry is necessary?
Well, what I take away from this is that life requires various things. Most people would agree that life requires water, food, you know, family and friends, maybe. And this is adding to that discussion and saying, hey, we also need poetry. I'm not one that appreciates poetry very much. A lot of times when I read poetry, I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, it would have been nice if you had just said this directly, but that's, you know, just me, Scrooge, I guess.
What would you say on the LSAT if you saw a statement that said, just simply, poetry is necessary, full stop. Poetry full is necessary, stop. Period. What would you say?
It's a little odd because it's like, for what, right?
There we go.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I really was trying to get at is necessary for what?
Yeah.
Poetry is necessary, but necessary for what? On in LSAT terms, there is no such thing as just necessary. There's also no such thing as just sufficient.
Yeah.
If poetry is necessary, Ben, you suggested maybe poetry is necessary for life. Maybe I think that's what they mean.
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to say. But yeah.
Okay. Now, if that were really literally true, if it said poetry is necessary for life, then what would that imply?
That would imply that without poetry, people wouldn't be able to live, or at least things wouldn't be able to live.
Yeah, and that if we were alive, then we must have poetry
in our life somehow, somewhere,
in
some form. Yeah.
So then it seems maybe that that bumper sticker negates itself.
What do you mean?
Well, poetry is necessary for life, but I'm here walking down the sidewalk perceiving it.
Yeah.
So I guess I must have poetry.
It's must.
It's just noting that poetry is necessary for life. Yeah. I'm being a little bit of a smart ass about it, you know, but it's pretty meaningless without saying what it's necessary for. Are you saying it's necessary for us to have a good education? Are you saying it's necessary for us to have peace among our, you know, fellow citizens?
Yeah.
Are you saying
or
it's
for love or for
necessary for love, necessary for happiness, necessary for what? You don't just get to say
for what. You're gonna go back and tag a little question on this car.
I'm like knocking on the door of the car window of the car. They roll it down and I'm just like, for what is it necessary?
God damn it. They're gonna throw a poem back at you.
Okay, well, anyway, we had enough fun with that. Let's move on to this item from Eric. He found it on Reuters. Again, Karen Sloan, who seems to be like one of the only reporters.
She's the only one we ever quote.
She's everywhere. I know. Karen Sloan. She's owning the law school beat. Anyway, there's an article here that says the law school survey. Oh, well, why don't you read it?
Okay, the Law School Survey of Student Engagement examined first-generation law students and found that what? And then Eric has kindly given us five bullet points here. One, first-generation students make up 26% of law students nationwide. Okay, so just to clarify here, we're talking about first-gen law students, right? So they're not necessarily first-gen grad or college students.
I would say it's very likely to be first gen college students.
Okay, because first gen law students, that's got to be super common. People who are doing law for the first time. Yeah, okay. 35% of first gen students are expected to graduate with $120,000 in student loan debt compared to 23% of non-first gen students. Okay. First-gen students in 2023 entered law school with an average LSAT score of 154 and 3.35 GPA compared to 157 and 3.44 for non-first-gen. Okay. First-gen students spend more time studying and working on than non-first-gen students and get slightly lower grades, B average compared to B plus.
Wow.
They're less likely to make journal or become involved in student organizations. Wow.
Yeah. If you want to dig into this study, it came out of LSSSE. What does that stand for? We've talked about this organization before. It's the Law School Survey of Student Engagement, LSSSE, part of Indiana University's Center for Post-Secondary Research, a research center in the School of Education, devoted to studying the student experience. What do you think about these findings? It's pretty damning to me. I mean, that paints a pretty bad picture of what law school is like for first gen students in my book. Like, there's subtle differences and they're not unexpected differences.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty damning though. You know, slightly lower grades, B average compared to B plus. That doesn't seem like maybe it's that big of a deal. But that's a big, big difference when you're talking about law school grades and employability.
Yeah, and they're not as likely to be on journal or get involved. That right. doesn't help either.
Oh, if I mean, journal is like the big prestigious journal on campus. A lot of times is like a nice pathway to big law. And so is good grades. You know, law school grades, people don't understand that the range of grades in law school is just wildly compressed. It's like everybody in every class you're ever going to take is going to get a B plus or an A minus.
Yeah,
you know, that's just that's how it is. That's the only grades you get. If you do your worst possible job, you're going to get a B minus. And if you totally like destroy, like your one best grade of your entire law school experience is an A.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like undergrad A plus, A plus, A plus, A, you know, it's like they're going to have a tight, at least at where I went to law school, they had a very tight curve.
Mm-hmm.
B plus was the average.
Yeah.
So if first gen students on average are getting slightly lower grades, oh, a B average compared to a B plus average.
Yeah.
Well, that's the difference between being average in your class and being below average in your class.
Yeah.
And if you're below average in your class, then like, you know, all of the best opportunities from that law school, poof, gone, because you're not going to be able to interview for those things. Or there's going to be some fancy clinic that they have on campus, but they're only going to take three students in the clinic and you're going to be competing based on grades.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's going to be, you know, just some other opportunity that you're going to lose out on because you're just not competing as well as everybody else there, which I wouldn't have bet you would. Because you're entering with 3 points lower LSAT, you're entering with 0.10 lower undergraduate GPA. You know, it's like the picture is pretty bleak for first generation law students. You're entering with worse stats. You're going to get worse grades while you're there. You're going to graduate with more debt. You're not going to get the best of the experiences while you're there. And then you add all that up and it, you know, they don't talk about employability here.
Yeah.
But all that paints a picture of a less employable student. Scary shit. I was a first generation law student. You were a first generation law student.
Are we defining first gen based on whether you're going to law school for the first time?
Yeah, let's dig in. Let's dig into it. Wait, hold on a second. It says 26% of all law students are first gen. So now We're not sure whether that means first in your family to go to law school or first in your family to go to college at all.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. Can we imagine that 75% of students are coming from families that had attorneys? I mean, maybe.
No, impossible. In fact, right in the introduction, it says first generation students are trailblazers for their families. They attend college without the guidance of a parent who has completed their own bachelor's degree.
Okay. So that's, I'm not a first gen.
So you're not a first gen. I am a first gen. My folks did not go to college. Ben's folks did go to college. So yep. I was first gen. I did all these things. I mean, I graduated with $120,000 plus in student loan debt. I got worse grades. I did not do journal or get involved at all. I didn't have any kind of connection. I didn't. So clueless. Wow. Anything else about this study? I mean, I do think people should go check out that article if they're interested.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think of this average of 157 and 3.44 for non-first gen students.
I mean, it's a much more attractive applicant than 3 points lower and 0.10 lower on GPA.
Yeah.
What are you just complain about how low it is overall?
Yeah, I'm just still okay, so it's an average, right? Which means you got people below that who are going to law school. It's like this seems like this number should be closer to the bottom of the pool of applicants who are actually going into law school.
Well,
I don't know. It just gets back to I think there's too many people going to law school.
Right. I think we're both clear. I mean, just I don't. You could put us up on the, you know, with the lie detector test and, you know, the firing squad ready to go or something and say, what do you think about the number of people going to law school? And I think both you and I would go, oh, wildly too many people going to law school.
Yeah.
It, like there's just not, there aren't going to be lucrative jobs for all these people.
I'd prefer the average to be in the low, mid 160s.
People are going to accuse us of like sounding elitist or whatever, you know, when we talk about this stuff. And I hope they don't take us the wrong way. People can improve their LSAT a lot. You know, like that's what we do, is we help people who come in scoring 140 or one, you know, something like this, scoring in the low 150s.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we're done with them, they're now scoring in the high 160s or something. The thing that's terrifying about this is if that really is the maximum of your potential, like your combination of your English, your reading, your vocabulary, your attention to detail, you know, and your very, very basic logic, just common sense logic. And if you actually try, and the most, you know, if you max out at a 154 or even that 157, which is the average for not first gen, if that's the top of your potential on the LSAT, I don't know. I can't imagine hiring a lawyer like that. You know,
there are obviously exceptions. There are people who score that well and end up killing it as an attorney. But
yep.
We're talking about exceptions as opposed to what's generally going to happen to that crop of students.
Big picture, painting with a real broad brush, you know, and it's a worse picture for these first gen students who are, you know, a third of them are graduating with $120,000 plus in debt. It's almost twice as many first gen students as not first gen students, by the way, who graduate with that much debt. It's, you know, it's a way worse scam for people who haven't had families who have gone to college. And, you know, I would like to see, actually, they should do a study where they actually do study people whose parents went to law school.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Then
there's so much knowledge
stark
coming down, because my parents,
oh, man,
as much as they went to college and everything, they were much more on the technical side. Right.
Right.
My dad was electrical engineering. He's kind of like, wait, you want to go to law school? What is that?
Yeah, you're like still 20 years later trying to figure out what it actually is.
I don't know, Dad. I'll tell you someday. Yeah.
Eek. Yeah, the story is bleak. I have a special place in my heart for first generation college students. I didn't get the most out of my undergrad. And I didn't get the most out of any of my grad school experiences. And I hope that we can shed some light but the thing that I'm the most horrified about, you know, law schools are like cheerleaders, like the schools themselves are cheerleaders for first generation students. But then they are also the ones who charge them $100,000 or more to go to their school.
It's really sad because it's such an easy position to take, right? Oh, we're supporting this upward mobility.
Access, justice, upward mobility, freedom for, you know, everybody should be able to get a law school education.
Yeah.
Everybody should. You know, no, oh, what? Your best LSAT is a 148? Yeah, but you still should be able to get it's for you. Law school's for you too.
Which would be great if they put their money where their mouth was. Yeah.
Right.
But that's not what's happening. Or at least as far as we can tell.
No, I mean, if this study is to be believed, right?
Yeah.
If their data are to be believed, then law schools are charging first gen students more.
Yeah. Yep.
For less.
Yeah.
For less, because you're going to graduate with a worse class ranking. You're not going to have done journal or have become as involved in clinics or student organizations or whatever else. You're going to work harder for lower grades and you're going to pay more.
Yep.
It's a raw deal. And that's why we say don't pay for law school, because you just don't have to. I mean, you can opt out of that bad outcome by just making sure that you get a scholarship.
Yep.
All right. Go check out that article if you want to learn more. And please tell us what you think of it. help@thinkinglsat.com. We got a couple ask button questions about timing. You ready to talk about timing?
Yeah. The number one says, so I'm noticing that I'm getting the questions wrong when I time myself. 1 minute and 30 seconds.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, that's yeah, there's 25 questions in the section and there's 35 minutes. So if you do the math, you get about a minute and a half per question.
Yeah, this is wild. I mean, this is an easy problem to solve. The person then says, do you recommend that I continue to time myself to get the question flow to be more smoother so I should spend less time on answering questions? I recognize that I tend to get the answers right without being timed, which could be problematic on LSAT test date if I'm not faster. Wow, you're really mixed up here. Not only do we not want you timing yourself on the individual questions, God forbid, we don't even want you thinking about time on the entire section.
Yeah, you need to learn the LSAT's most important lesson, which is that you've just got to ignore the clock. You've got to answer the questions on your own pace, whatever pace that is, that's going to make you get them right. And if you practice that, and if you learn to just not try to go fast, try to go deep, try to get it right, try to solve it, the better you'll get at solving the questions, the faster you'll get at solving the questions, and you'll end up without really having a speed problem. But you're only going to compound the speed problem if you try to go fast, because you're just, you can't do that. You can't force yourself to solve the puzzle any faster than your brain wants to solve the puzzle.
Yeah, and this is so bad too, because a minute 30 seconds per question totally misses the reality that on some questions you're going to answer them in, it's crazy, but 30 seconds.
I do
but
that.
Others, yeah.
I do that in Double Black Diamond. You know, I taught a bonus episode of Double Black Diamond yesterday in honor of the LSAT moving forward toward a highly logical reasoning oriented future.
Yeah.
I did an extra class of our expert level Double Black Diamond class. And in that class, I do all level five, maybe some level fours sneak in there, hard logical reasoning questions.
Yeah.
And it's just so stark, because some of them are going to take us 15 minutes to discuss, and other ones are going to take 45 seconds for me to do the question, and then nobody in the class has any questions. And it's like, okay, well, we sorted that one out in no time.
Yeah.
There are shortcuts there, even on the hardest questions, even on, you know, question number 22 at, you know, the real nasty one that they've got buried at the end of the section. If you attack that argument well enough, there's shortcuts. They have the test laid out for you to take shortcuts. But you've got to be present enough to recognize them and to take them. Like, for example, we had one yesterday where the argument made no sense. I would describe the argument as highly attenuated, meaning they've got a premise, and then they got another like kind of related premise, and then they got another kind of related premise, and then they got a conclusion.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, that is not an LSAT argument.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there's a hole here and a hole here and a hole here and a hole here. I can't, holy shit. Like, you're so far away.
Premises about bananas and a conclusion about astronauts or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And it turns out to be a strengthen question. Took us a while to wade through the argument. Took us a while to wade through the answer choices. The correct answer turns out to be E on this question. So it's like, okay, so here's how you make a hard question, right? You give a really shitty argument. You ask a strengthen question, which has a pretty wide range of possible correct answers. All you got to do is just make the argument better somewhat. Then you put four shitty answers, A, B, C, D. And then finally on E, you put the right answer and added difficulty bonus. And we see this on LR and on reading comp. The correct answer turned out to be related to a gap between the first sentence. There was a conclusion and a premise. It said blah 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 for blah blah blah. And so they're presenting, here's my conclusion and here's a premise.
Here's my intermediate conclusion, maybe. Is that what you're saying?
Nope. There was no intermediate conclusion. It was XYZ for
this reason.
ABC.
Yeah.
And the ABC was meant as a reason for the the conclusion, but it didn't make sense. Yeah. You know, it was just like, whoa, those are two different things. Are you saying that those are the same thing? What are you trying to do here?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, long story short, the correct answer turned out to be a bridge between the conclusion and the premise, which were in the first sentence.
So nothing else mattered.
Right. So there's this big gap between, you know, the initial problem with the argument, which was right off the bat. And then there were further problems, but it was initial problem right off the bat.
Yep.
Strengthen question. And then they bury the correct answer down at the bottom of the answer choices. And there was a shortcut there. The shortcut was get pissed about the argument right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a nice job, but I'm patting myself on the back. But as I did the question yesterday, I was mad about it. When I read that first sentence, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold on a second. You're trying to do logic here. I can see you using these words that signal that you're doing some reasoning, right? Like you've reached a conclusion and you've given me a premise, but your premise doesn't back up your conclusion. So what the fuck are you even doing here? Smash cut 5 minutes later, I'm seeing the correct answer at the buried at the bottom of the answer choices. And it's like, oh yeah. Remember how I was mad about that 5 minutes ago?
Yep.
That's and it was like became bulletproof. It became like, yeah, for sure. I know that that's the answer. 100%.
Yep.
I guess all I'm trying to say here is that imagine the student who was like trying to do that question in a minute and a half. I think you're going to get so in the weeds of the bad argument and so in the weeds of the wrong answer choices. And you're going to be just comparing wrong answer choices to one another instead of being able to. You know, like, it's kind of like stick to your guns, like get pissed as you're reading the passage. That's the critical thing.
Get pissed and, at the jumps in reasoning, right?
Right. And you can't be also watching the clock and trying to pay attention to these gaps in reasoning.
Well, and you can't do that in a minute and 30 seconds. You can do some questions in 30 seconds and you can do others in 3 minutes. You don't know which ones are going to require more time, but you don't care about any of that
right.
because the questions that go right. faster give you that leverage to take more time when you need it.
Absolutely. So our advice for our ask button questioner here is stop timing yourself on individual questions.
For sure.
Stop timing yourself on individual questions. By the way, when you're doing your work in the demon is secretly timing you on the questions in the background. So that it can adjust the difficulty of the questions that you're going to see while you're drilling.
Yeah.
But all your job is just to get them right. Your job is not to pay attention to the time. You just get them right.
Think about that. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so
Add to that, by the way, if anyone is like letting that affect them, they're like, oh, I know the demon's timing me. Hands down, accuracy is going to matter way more. You get something wrong. Boom. That's going to drop your performance metrics way more than getting a question slowly.
Yeah, good, which it should.
Yes.
I mean, a missed question it's a double whammy, right?
Yeah.
It's the world's biggest waste of time. Because you spent some time on that question. You know, if you were this student and you spent 1 minute and 25 seconds on the question and you're like patting yourself on the back about, oh, yeah, great. I made it. I did it in under 1 minute and 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you missed it. Oh, congratulations. You completely wasted 1 minute and 25 seconds and you got a wrong answer.
Yep.
You know, I would much rather you spent 2.5 minutes on that question and got it right. Or 3.5 minutes on that question and got it right.
Yeah.
We have to learn to get paid. Stuart, in one of our classes, he in his teaching notes, Stuart posted that he had been talking to his class about the concept of billable hours.
Mm.
Lawyers get paid for their time.
Yes. Right? And some hours aren't billable. Is this where you're going?
Well, if you miss a question, congratulations. You know, you just spent the weekend working on some brief and then you submitted it and it comes back. Oh, you're totally off. You're writing about the wrong like you missed the issue entirely.
Yep. And we can't bill the client for this shit. So So
no, but you can't build a client for that. Are you kidding? Like this work product that it will make them lose. You can't build them for that. And so you're back to the drawing board and, you know, you get paid zero for that.
Yeah. Doesn't count towards your annual billable hours because it's by definition not billable.
Yeah. One of the reasons, I guess, why big law firm lawyers work, you know, 70, 80 hours a week because they got to bill 50.
Yep.
And they end up having all this junk time in there where they're not actually, you know, anyway. Don't want to stretch the analogy too far, but lesson here is you got to slow down. You got to focus on just solving these questions. Focusing on time is not going to help you get faster. It's going to make you less accurate. It's going to make you waste time to focus on the time. Second question. If a question's giving me a hard time, should I flag it and come back at the end? Is there such a thing as too long on any one question? Go ahead, Ben.
No, don't. Okay. First of all, don't flag it and plan on coming back.
Totally.
I don't have a problem with someone eventually saying, okay, I can't figure this out. This is the best I can do and moving on. But then you're moving on.
I think that actually happens a lot. You know,
I think
students are like, oh, but you know, if I was Nathan, then I would solve every question perfectly and I would never have any doubts. That's not true. That's not how it works. How it works is I get as close as I'm going to get. And then I just decide. Okay. And you're right. 90% of the time, 95% of the time, maybe more, I am unlocking the question where I've solved it. But that doesn't mean that I solve every single one completely. Many questions or, you know, on any section, there's going to be a handful of them. And they can appear anywhere in the section. I think that they happen more closer to the end of the section, but they happen in the middle of the section and the beginning of the section even as well, where I took my time with it. I read it carefully. I tried to make a prediction. I read the question. I understood what I was being asked. I knew what I was looking for when I went into the answers. But then I just didn't quite find it. Like I didn't find anything that made me really happy. And in that case, I'm probably going to have it narrowed down to 0, 1, or God forbid, 2 answers. But, you know, I'm going to narrow it down as far as I can get, like get rid of the ones that I know are complete trash. But then often there's going to be an answer where it's like, you know, I don't love this answer. I can't quite put my finger on it, though, what it is that I don't totally love about it. And I just can't see myself really picking any of these other answers. So I'm going to pick it and move on. Other times I might have it down to a 50-50 even, you know, like, well, I know it's one of these two answers, but I really can't differentiate between the two of them. But my gut's telling me that it's probably this one, not that one. If I'm not making any progress towards solving the question, if I don't feel like I'm getting any closer, then I have to just pick something and move on. That has to happen. You have to do that at some point.
Yeah.
So we focus so much on solving, and that is what you should do. You know, when you're drilling, when you're doing your time sections, you really should try to solve. But there is a point where you're not getting any closer to solving. And so everybody does have to come to terms with that, like that in their own process, right? That's why you have to do timed sections, by the way, because you've got to get used to this idea that, you know, I am going to solve the majority of these questions, but on some of them, you know, I'm not going to quite get all the way there.
Yeah.
And that's okay too. You just fucking pick something and move on.
Yeah. And that's okay. I think the reason we focus so much on solving is that almost, it feels like everyone, when they start this journey, it's much more of this, okay, do it quickly.
Oh,
pick an answer.
At the end of their journey, right? I mean, most students, whether they've been with us for 3 days or 3 months, most students go too fast. They try to go too fast.
Yep.
Everybody's problem is you're trying to go too fast.
Or they get it down to 2 and they just guess. And they're like, I got it down to 2. And they're celebrating that victory. And it's kind of like, that's actually a celebration that everyone else just had too. You're not in some sort of special boat.
Right. I want you to do one more lap on that, right? Like, if you get it down to 2, okay, good. Then compare those 2 together. Like, let's get serious about it. If one of them's right and one of them's wrong, then we have an opportunity here to turn a half a point into a full point by figuring out which one it is.
Yep.
And that's, yeah. I mean, we do spend like 99% of our time talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But today, I do want to also make it clear that you can't sit there for 15 minutes on any one question. Like, you do have to at some point decide, okay, I am smart enough to understand this stuff. I do usually solve these questions. This one, I'm not, for whatever reason, I'm not like unlocking it 100%, but I'm also not getting any closer to unlocking it. So I have to pick the one that I think has the best chance of being right. And then you just got to be okay with it, right? You've just got to go, okay, fine. Like, that's my answer. Might be right, might be wrong.
Yeah.
But answer and move on. Do not during your timed sections try to flag questions and then go back to them.
Yeah.
Don't. Like, you can't compete with the people you're competing with by dividing your attention into 1,000 different buckets like that. You got to be like on the question that you're on. Get as close as you're going to get, answer it, and then be 100% devoted to the next question.
Great.
I hope that's helpful.
Yeah.
It, you know, there is such a thing as too long on any one question, but you don't learn that from the clock. You learn that from, am I getting closer toward the answer? Does it feel like I'm increasing my understanding? Because I can read it one more time if I'm still increasing my understanding. But at some point, you get to the point, you know, your wheels are just totally spinning. You're not making any traction at all. Okay, well then pick something. Move on. Want to talk to Nikki? Nikki describes herself as an untraditional student.
Okay. Hi, team. I am an untraditional student. We'll hopefully start law school in the fall of 2025 and will be 32 years old then. Do you think she's, I guess, old?
That's a little older, but it's not. I think it's silly to be calling this non-traditional.
Yeah.
There are many, many people that age who go to law school. You know, even if it's only 5 or 10% of your class, it's still not like it's a shocker that there's slightly older people there.
Nikki continues, I only have one option for school in my state, which has a part-time program, as I cannot afford to not work while in school.
Good.
I work full-time as a paralegal. I hear you talking about people applying to a few different schools, but I don't see the reason for me, as I cannot relocate out of state for personal reasons. What would my outcome be if I applied to a bunch of schools I will not be able to attend anyway? So I'd love it if you could discuss that in your future podcast. Thanks, Nikki.
I mean, I think you should do it just so that you would know your worth in the marketplace. Like, how do you arrive at a reasonable price with the one school in your state that has a part-time program? How do you arrive at a price with them if you don't know what price other schools want to charge you?
Exactly. This is more to help you negotiate and advocate for yourself.
Yeah, even if your full intent, you know, you can have one target school like this. That school makes the most sense for you. Fine. I believe you that school makes the most sense for you, but not until we settle on a price. So, yeah, I think you got to apply broadly so that you can let the market tell you what your application should be worth so that you can then negotiate better with the school that you do want to go to.
And I would add this one other piece here, Nikki. It sounds like you're stuck in the state and this part-time program is the only program that will work for you when you finally start law school. But I will say there are things that have happened throughout my life that completely changed.
Oh yeah. God,
where I thought I was going to be even just 6 months back. 6 months ago, I thought, hey, this is what I'm going to be doing in the next 2 years, 5 years, whatever. A year later, I'm looking back going, holy shit, things have changed. And I'm not at all where I thought I would be, good or bad, right? It's like,
yeah, it's like the story of, at some point, I think it's the story of everyone's life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, wow, I did not think that was going to work out that way.
Yep.
couldn't have possibly predicted that. And how could we possibly have predicted that, right? In our lifetimes, Ben, we have 9/11, global pandemic.
Yeah.
Space shuttle explosion. Nah, I don't know. What else did we have that was a big deal?
Well, those are like kind of macro events, right? But even this micro events, things happen, certain maybe family members pass away.
Oh, you fall in love, you get divorced, somebody in your family, God forbid, gets sick, you have a kid, you... There's so much that can happen. Yeah. I mean, and it by the way, it doesn't stop. I mean, I'm here to report from my mid to late 40s. And I'm telling you that in the mid to late 40s, it still keeps happening.
Yeah.
And I've been 8 different people in the last 20 years of my life.
All that's to say that if you apply to these multiple schools and you're dead set on this one school in your state, first of all, you don't need to tell them.
No.
But things might change. You might be like, holy shit, actually, that school over in that other state yonder there.
And we've seen it happen.
Looks good to me now.
Yeah, we've seen it happen. Right. And, you know, I would also encourage Nikki to consider various, you know, there's these days, especially when you're talking about part-time programs, there are innovative programs out there. There are programs that are moving more and more online. Mm. Nikki, there might be options for you to go, you might be able to go weekends to some other school that you hadn't considered. Who knows? But I'm going to go back to my original advice. You can't have a reasonable discussion about the price if you're only negotiating with one school. These schools are negotiating with thousands of other applicants.
Yep.
You know, they are in such a more powerful position than you are. Even if you apply to 15 schools, they're still in a vastly more powerful position because they have thousands of applications.
They have
and they do this every single year. They do it over and over and over. They are experts at this.
Yeah.
And you're coming in as a complete novice. If you apply to one school, you're going to take whatever offer they are generous enough to give you. But if you apply to multiple schools, then you're going to have other options. And when you have other options, you can push back a little bit on the deals that you're being offered.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you. All right. This one is coming from someone named Cautiously Optimistic, Possibly Delusional. That's their name that they gave themselves. The subject is a felony in 2023 from an incident in 2021.
Hmm. Okay. I'm a former family practice healthcare provider and have always had an extreme interest in the practice of law, semicolon. I am particularly fascinated by healthcare law. During my practice as a provider, there was a situation that was investigated, and after investigators told me that I was, quote, already going to federal prison, I made the uninformed decision, without the counsel of an attorney, to not be forthcoming with certain details out of fear. Fast forward to 2 years later, I received an indictment and later a conviction on 18 U.S.C. 1001 false statement due to the withholding. Only 3 states disqualify felons from taking the bar. Producer Eric looked that up. Texas, Kansas, and Mississippi disqualify felons from taking the bar. Cautiously Optimistic and Possibly Delusional continues, I have spoken to admissions at several schools and have been informed that it isn't an immediate disqualification. My UGPA was 3.7 and my LSAT goal is 175 plus, with a goal of applying to schools after the logic game gets dropped. So waiting to not study the games. Interesting. Why? Games are like the most solvable section of the test. But okay, anyway. Would I ever have a chance at admission? I have no intention of applying anywhere that doesn't offer merit or need-based scholarship. We have a little more information here. Yale has a page. We can link this in the show notes. Yale has a page on applying with a criminal record. They also, this is Yale's page, they also link to helpforfelons.org, which says, quote, yes, usually a felon can apply to get a license to practice law. However, one should absolutely plan on the application to be thoroughly scrutinized. It'll be a hard road to travel, but it is usually possible. And then they talk about Reginald Dwayne Betts, who was once sentenced to 8 years in prison Now he's a Yale law grad and a MacArthur fellow for his work on criminal justice reform and increasing access to literature in prisons. Wow.
Hmm.
So there's somebody who went to the best law school in the country with a felony. So it's possible.
Yeah, it's possible. I do think the lower ranked you go in terms of law school, the less scrutiny they're going to apply, even though they're still going to apply scrutiny. Obviously, Yale can apply scrutiny on any of their applicants, let alone felons. I think any other law school, even if it's lower ranked, would still be concerned and thus want to know more. But look, school's got to fill seats. You got a good GPA, you got a good LSAT. I don't think they report the number of felons on their 509. So as long as they feel comfortable with what happened, I don't see it being a huge roadblock, especially if you apply broadly.
I would start by calling my state bar, if I were you, and I would explain to them exactly the situation. I mean, I would share with them all the information that you shared with us.
Don't withhold.
Yeah, I mean, like, find out what your state bar says about your particular felony. Ask them if there are any things that you need to do to rehab your application. Ask them if you're going to have character and fitness issues when you apply to the bar. I mean, you should also, it sounds like there's some possibly shady shit in your record.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a conviction about the false statement. But is the other stuff like still active legal matters? I don't know. Do you really want people poking into your shit? Because like that's what's going to happen when you apply for the bar.
Yep.
You're going to have like some investigators who are going to like go back and dig into all this shit. So if you can handle that, you know, then great. But if you can't handle that, maybe this is something you want to not get yourself into.
Yeah.
You got any other advice for cautiously optimistic, possibly delusional?
No, I think that's great. Figure out what the state bar, how they react. You might need to call multiple states, depending on where you plan to apply, see how they react, and then apply broadly. You're going to have to throw a wider net to find schools that interpret your situation differently.
Next one is from Sarthak, and the subject is GRE versus LSAT dilemma.
Hi, Nathan and Ben. I'm a law school applicant applying to a few T14 schools this cycle. Okay, it's the end of October. I don't know what you mean by few. I took the GRE last month and bagged a perfect quant and verbal score, i.e. 170 verbal and 170 quant. I scored 5 out of 6 on the writing section of the GRE. Do you think it is wise for me to take the LSAT now? All the schools I'm applying to state that they have no preference between the LSAT and the GRE. They consider both tests equally. When I called the schools and asked why there are so few GRE applicants, they all told me that this was because so few applicants applied with the GRE scores.
Yeah.
In addition, they told me the GRE applicants have roughly the same success rate as LSAT applicants. Could you please share your thoughts on this? Is it wise for high GRE scorers to take the LSAT? The dilemma arises specifically because once I take the LSAT, my GRE scores will become practically useless because schools report LSAT reports for candidates with LSAT plus GRE scores. Thanks.
I'd be interested to see what happens if you just apply with a GRE. You know, the only way we would really know is if you apply with just your GRE, then turn down all the offers, then apply again, you know, take the LSAT and apply again and compare the offers. That's really the only way we would be able to know.
I do see the dilemma, though, right? Because how do the law schools equate the 170-170 to the LSAT? I mean, in theory, those are two perfect scores. Are they going to equate that to a 175, a 178, a 180 in their heads, or at least during their indexing? I wonder how they do that in terms of the index formula. But it could end up being a very good equivalent.
I'm looking at Yale's 509.
Yep.
They only had 18 GRE admissions enrollees. Oh, okay. That's what they had in 2022. Have you noticed? I was having a moment yesterday where I was thinking about this stuff, and I was like, the 2022 Standard 509 Information Report it doesn't come out until the end, the very end of 2022. So then for all of 2023, the best consumer information that we have is coming from last fall's enrollees. All the way up until the end of 2023, the only information that we have is still from last fall.
From fall of 2022?
Right now, right? Yeah. I mean, it is right now, October 31st. Happy Halloween, everybody. And I'm looking at the most recent disclosure from Yale, and it was printed on, report generated on 12/28/2022. So all the schools wait until the very end of the very end, like the last, you know, it's almost like they have to disclose it in 2022. So they wait until the last business day of 2022.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how this all works, but it's like, man, okay, so you can't tell us, huh? Until, like right now, Yale can't tell us about their current class. I mean, that class started on September 1st. So it's been solidly 2 months, and we still have to wait another 2 months before we finally get, it's 4 months after the class starts that we get these new reports. I mean, whatever, I get, they've got a lot on their plate, huh, man?
Yeah, or maybe they incorporate into the numbers people who stick through the semester, but it's just about admissions, so I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so Yale, you know, it's the most competitive law school in the country. Their LSAT range was from, well, 175 is the median, 25th percentile, 171, 75th percentile, 178 at Yale last year.
Okay. Okay. So the middle 50% is 171 to 178. Okay.
Yeah. They had 18 GRE admissions enrollees. Of those, the median verbal score was 170 and the median quant score was 168.
Hmm.
So the verbal scores ranged from 160, 25th percentile GRE verbal reasoning, 169. One less than perfect is their 25th percentile.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Yale is telling you, you don't have to be perfect on GRE verbal, but boy, you got to be damn close to perfect on GRE verbal.
Yeah.
And then GRE quant, little wiggle room, but not that much, down to a 161 on the low end, which is to be expected that law school applicants wouldn't be as good on the quant side.
Yeah. So in terms of the writing, the analytical writing, their 25th percentile is 5. So in that sense, this applicant is a little bit like a splitter.
Yeah. Why didn't you score 6 out of 6? Yeah. Hmm. The writing score is actually bad compared to other Yale enrollees.
Hmm.
That's Yale.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, you're in the 75th percentile for quant and verbal. At Yale, you're also in the 50th percentile, I guess, for
Harvard. Yeah. 50th percentile. So Harvard has 57 GRE admissions enrollees. Harvard is a much bigger law school. We're talking about 564 people in the first year class.
Yeah.
Of those, 57 of them were admitted with just GRE. So a little over 10%, actually. Harvard's been accepting the GRE for longer than other schools. Their 50th percentile GRE verbal 168, 50th percentile GRE quant 166, and the 50th percentile on the analytical writing is a 5.
Yeah, I don't know.
Your GRE profile makes you pretty competitive there.
Yeah. I might just apply. Unless you know you can score very high on the LSAT, but you're already done.
It's funny because we take a position which I think people would be kind of surprised to take. It's like, see, because we're like, ah, just go ahead and apply. Because then if you don't like any of your offers, you just turn them all down.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's shocking to law school students or to LSAT. Like, people who are listening to us are like, what? I would never do that.
Yeah.
And we're like, why not? It's this whole big game. It's a casino, you know, every single year we just play the same stupid game over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a great, you know, like, yeah, maybe Sarthak can just save, like, just don't even do LSAT prep at all. Just apply and see what happens.
Yeah.
The thing you just got to be willing to do is to turn down bad offers.
Yep.
Which we know we would happily do, but you know, whether other people would do that, we don't know.
I mean, these GRE scores are reported on the 509, so they are, you know, they
yeah,
they move the needle, and you got the best scores you can get in quant and verbal.
Are they included in the GRE? Or sorry, are they included in US News?
They've got to be part of modernization. I bet they are.
I'm going to say they're not. I'm going to say they only use the LSAT because they have LSAT for every student at every school. Ah, shit. Median LSAT and GRE scores. LSAT and GRE percentile scales were weighted by the proportions of test takers submitting each exam. For example, if 85% of exams submitted were LSATs and 15 submitted were GREs, the LSAT percentile would be multiplied by 0.85 and the average percentile of the three GRE exams by 0.15 before summing the two values. So GRE scores were never converted to LSAT scores or vice versa. But US News does weight the, yeah. So yeah, I mean, it is possible. We'd have to see, right? It's so rare that people apply with just GRE. At least we never see those people. So I don't know what kinds of offers these people get.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on where you go and it depends on what kind of scholarship you're hoping for. As long as you're willing to turn down bad offers, I don't think there's any problem though with Sarthak applying.
And I think there's a decent, GRE. Yeah, I think there's a decent chance here. I mean, if you kind of migrate over, you say, well, look, you're above the 75th percentile. You're, you know, that would put you above a 176 at whatever school or one set. Okay. So unless you think you can beat that, go for it.
Yeah. I mean, you will raise the profile of most schools, Sarthak. You will raise their estimation. You know, their ranking in US News goes up if they admit you with your 170, 170.
Yep. Cool.
Many. Yeah. Thanks, Sarthak. Many says, gap semester? I just listened to your episode on study schedules and was wondering if I would have to explain a gap semester in my personal statement. I have one semester left in my degree, but decided this summer I want to write the LSAT. So I took this fall semester off. I will be graduating next semester, but was wondering if that will negatively affect my application.
Not at all. And you definitely do not need to explain it in your personal statement. If a school specifically asks, then you would be saying something in an addendum, such as I just wanted to take a semester off or something.
Maybe you couldn't get the classes that you needed in order to graduate.
Yeah.
I mean, you already were like, yeah, that happens all the time, that you can't graduate without a certain class. So you take a semester off and wait, take that certain class the next semester.
Yeah.
Somebody could have gotten sick. Somebody could have gotten married. You could have had some, I don't know. There's a million things that you could be doing in that time. I don't see any need to explain. What's the point? You're focusing on not a strength of your application. So just don't focus on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Simple enough. Thanks, Minnie. We have an email here from Anonymous.
Yeah. It says, hello, a friend of mine who went to law school recently mentioned when I was talking about the LSAT, that some schools take into account if you scheduled / went on a tour there. I'm not sure where they heard that or about what school, and I haven't heard that on any of y'all's podcast episodes. Just figured I'd ask if that sounds like something that ever happens. Thanks. They certainly might tag that information. I'm sure they're I'm very confident they tag that information. I think they even tag things like, how many emails from us have you opened? How quickly did you open them? I heard about this in the price that you pay for college. Now that's undergrad tactics, but I wouldn't be surprised that law schools aren't employing the same tactics to gauge interest and so forth, right? As they're looking at all their applicants.
Well, because they're trying to figure out what price they want to charge you, right?
Yeah, and they want to see how interested you are.
In the undergrad game,
yeah,
they're actually looking at, okay, so this guy opened all seven of our emails and they opened them within 4 minutes or whatever. So they're like, exactly, this guy's really hot to go to our school.
Exactly.
So we can charge him extra.
Yep.
That's the game.
That's the game.
God, it's gross.
And they get they got these tactics, not surprisingly, from hiring consultants who I think then a lot of schools end up hiring, right? So the same ideas get passed around to everybody.
It all comes down to McKinsey just fucking everything up for everybody. Yeah, okay, sure. That makes total sense then, you know? Yeah, I mean, and if they were serious about offering you admission and or scholarships, you know, if you're just blowing it out of the water on your LSAT and your GPA, then probably none of this shit matters. But if they're on the fence, if they're not 100% sure, then yeah, I guess that school visit might matter to them. But matter to them which way? Like, I don't think it's going to matter to them in the sense that they're going to give you more money.
No. No, if anything, they're going to be like, okay, so you're interested in us. I mean, unless you have an amazing, yeah, record, and therefore they're worried about yield protection and they're worried that you're not actually going to accept their acceptance, then that could maybe help you, like show you're a little more serious. But in most cases, it seems like it's only going to hurt you. They're going to say, oh, this person's really interested, so we don't need to offer as much of a discount to get them to come.
Yeah.
It's not going to help you in the way that I think a lot of people are thinking. They're like, oh, can I get 3 more points on the LSAT or can I go visit the school?
Right.
And oh, yeah, now they're going to like me more. No, that's not going to help you in that way.
No, the school visit could definitely. Yeah, they might see you like they might see you as a target, right? They might see you as a whale. Like mm-hmm. when you show up with mom and dad and mom and dad are both attorneys.
Yep.
You know, I think they kind of look at you as like, okay, put a target on that one.
Yep.
They like, got money. We'd love to admit this student. They're going to be successful at our school. Also, let's try to charge them full price.
Yep.
So when you show up, you should look poor. Is that what we're saying? If you're going to do a campus tour, you should wear like a burlap sack.
That's the plan. You heard it here, folks. Thank you.
All right. I think we could probably wrap it up there. But before we go, Ben, I wanted you to read this little shout outs section here at the very end.
Sure. So, okay. So this is a review from Chris's The Final Passage reading comp class. It says, Chris did a really amazing job at helping me truly understand what in the heck the author was trying to tell us. I just reread and answered the questions again, and it just all fell into place, and I understood the passage so much better this time. I enjoy all, in all caps, of Chris's classes. He is so patient, thoughtful, and kind to everyone in class. I think Chris's mom did a great job raising her son. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, LSAT Demon, for all the great classes and teachers. Chris is a nice guy. He's funny, too.
Oh, he's funny as shit. Yeah, he's a 1L at Wash U in St. Louis, and he is teaching classes for us at LSAT Demon. He's also helping to manage our teachers. He's our head teacher at LSAT Demon these days. I mean, besides me and Ben. But Chris is does a lot of the hiring and training and that kind of stuff. And he does do an amazing job in all of his classes. So, yeah, great job, Chris. Great job, all of our LSAT Demon teachers.
Yeah.
You can be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about LSAT Demon, email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 427 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.